Welcome to the America's Quarterly Podcast. I'm Brian Winter. Recent weeks have definitely brought their fair share of surprises for the U.S.-Mexico relationship. What can we expect of bilateral relations going forward under the new administration?
So we're going to see a multidimensional, much more nuanced approach, but in many ways a much more traditional approach. I think that the logic for AMLO is still there. It's about, I want to keep them out of my business. I'll do whatever it takes to make sure that I still have that freedom at home.
During a particularly tough time for Latin America, what's happened these last few weeks in Mexico stands out. The country's official tally of COVID cases has passed the 1 million mark. Hurricanes have rattled parts of the country. That was in October, as did protests over unrelenting violence against women. With 3,000 Mexicans murdered last month, this year remains on track to be Mexico's most violent ever. And then there's the diplomatic front, where things have been nearly as turbulent. The government was rocked by last month's arrest of former Defense Minister Salvador Cienfuegos on charges of drug trafficking and money laundering, charges that tied organized crime to the top echelons of Mexican government in a way that had never happened before. But then, just as shocking, was the United States' decision to drop those charges completely and send Cienfuegos back to Mexico. So it's a lot. And to try to help us make sense of these recent developments and where Mexico's headed under López Obrador, I am joined by my friend Duncan Wood. Duncan is the director of the Mexico Institute at the Wilson Center and an expert on Mexico and U.S.-Mexico ties. Duncan, welcome to the America's Quarterly Podcast.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be with you. And, you know, you just said, you know, it's a lot. I have to say that I always find that it's a lot with Mexico. I often begin lectures by saying it's a great time to be studying Mexico, but then it's always a great time to be studying Mexico because there's always so much going on. But you're right. This has been obviously an exceptional year. And the recent history of Mexican politics and of U.S.-Mexico relations has really just taken us into almost a new dimension of strangeness. And I think many people are hoping to see some kind of return to normalcy or something like normalcy in 2021.
Well, and to be clear, you know, with that initial framing that I just gave, if somebody's listening from Mexico and saying, gosh, it sounds like you're being a little negative here. I mean, I don't know. Mexico is a country that I lived in for a year back in 2004-05. It's a country I love for many reasons. But I have to say, you know, like I said in the intro, even in the context of this big Latin American story, which has been so tough in 2020, these recent events really do stand out. But let's go one by one here and see if we can bring some order, or at least some analysis to understand it better by the time we're done. When you heard that the U.S. was dropping those charges against the former defense minister, against Cienfuegos, what was your initial reaction and how has it evolved since then?
I guess my initial reaction was, I'm not surprised that I'm surprised again, because this seems to be the order of the day. Both, you know, during the Trump administration for the past 4 years, we've got used to being surprised in domestic politics, but also in foreign policy, and specifically, you know, when it comes to Mexico. But the last 2 years of the AMLO administration, you know, there has been obviously an attempt, a successful attempt on the part of the government and the president to control the agenda in a very real way. And it's not just by holding his morning press conferences, the famous mañaneras. It's by saying often shocking things or things that go against the established wisdom. So that was my first reaction. I'm not surprised that I'm surprised. But then secondly, just a desperate search through my brain to try to find reasons why this would happen. And yes, we all went to the sort of the official declaration and the cause of justice needs to be sacrificed for foreign policy considerations or whatever the language was. And it seemed very, very peculiar. And everybody, it seemed, had a different potential explanation for this. You know, I don't think we can discount the very special and unique relationship between AMLO and President Trump. I don't think we can discount the very special conditions of the bilateral relationship right now in terms of the dependency that the United States has on Mexican collaboration and cooperation in stopping Central American migration. But I also think that, you know, there's certain principles that we had been pushed to forget about, especially those regarding national sovereignty, have come back with a bang during the AMLO administration. And I know that that is sort of going back to the official explanation from the Mexican side, which was, you know, the complaints that we heard from AMLO and from Secretary of Foreign Affairs Ebrard saying that, you know, they should have been consulted before the arrest of Cienfuegos. But I do think that it plays a role. I really do. And I'm reminded of conversations that I had back in 2013 at the beginning of the Peña Nieto administration with U.S. government officials who said, look, ultimately, it's the Mexicans who will determine the extent of our cooperation because they have to allow us access. And if they don't want to, there's not a lot that we can do. And so whether or not it was a threat to throw DEA agents out of the country or to significantly curtail collaboration on organized crime and narco trafficking, this is a great example of where the weaker partner in a relationship was able to demand and successfully extract a concession from the stronger partner.
What's driving that, based on what I'm hearing here, was a... Is nationalism the right word? I mean, at least a defense of national interests as seen from Mexico. That sounds a lot like the doctrine over the last 4 years of America's first here in the United States under Donald Trump. So I've wondered sometimes if the people in the White House heard that argument, that nationalist sovereign argument, and kind of went, yeah, actually, that's a reasonable request. I mean, do you think that played any role in this?
It's an interesting point, Brian. I mean, certainly part of the meeting of minds between Presidents López Obrador and Trump comes down to nationalism, in particular economic nationalism. There's no doubt that Trump is a nationalist. There's no doubt that López Obrador is a nationalist. And so I think there's a certain degree of respect there. Whether or not that came to play in this particular decision, I'm not sure. I think that there were other maybe personal factors. There may be that there was a sense that the United States government owed Mexico for its collaboration on migration and on various other issues. And, you know, there may be an element of domestic politics here in the United States as well. But certainly, I think that, that's one of the more interesting and surprising elements of the Trump-AMLO relationship. We go back to 2017 and early 2018, and yeah, we all sat here and we said there's going to be trouble between these two individuals, and there hasn't been.
I would have never guessed ever that they would have gotten along as well as they appear to have. They found this equilibrium and were able to work together and show some apparently legitimate enthusiasm, at least for the policy outcomes. I would have never believed that at the beginning of 2018.
No, and I have to say that from a political science, international relations perspective, the way that AMLO and his team have managed the relationship with the United States, understanding that for the past 2 years, delivering on migration will get you a free pass on a number of other issues, I think that there's a brilliant simplicity to that. And I think that has worked exceedingly well for the last 2 years.
I just want to linger on the Cienfuegos arrest. I have one more question about it, which is, there is another element to this that seems more structural, which is AMLO's relationship with Mexico's military, where it seems, or there's been at least reports, that there was extreme pressure to bring Cienfuegos back to Mexico, not have him prosecuted in the U.S. What does this tell us about AMLO's relationship and dependence on the military? And can you just describe that relationship for our audience that knows Latin America but may not follow Mexican politics on a day-to-day basis?
The fact that AMLO has such a strange relationship with the military comes down to the very beginning, at its foundations, the fact that the military has often been very suspicious of AMLO. There has not been a good relationship between López Obrador and the Mexican military for years and years in each of his presidential attempts. You know, we heard that the military was very suspicious of him. Of course, during the election campaign in 2018, we heard that AMLO wanted to get the military off the street. Not that they wouldn't like that, but what were the implications of that? As it turns out, AMLO has depended more on the military than any president in recent memory. What he's done is he has tasked them with a whole range of jobs that they don't necessarily want to be doing, including, you know, the traditional things of making sure that there is law and order in the country in some of the more lawless areas of the country. The more recent job of countering organized crime, which the military traditionally has not enjoyed and doesn't really want to be involved in that. The traditional efforts to respond to natural disasters, the Mexican military has always played a very important role on that. But now the president has got them involved in the construction business, in some of his infrastructure projects, in building banks and hospitals. And of course, we cannot forget that the military itself has been called upon to provide the human resources, the human capital for the construction of the National Guard in Mexico. AMLO's marquee trademark public security strategy, and that's really all there is that we have to go to, because we still haven't seen a national security strategy laid out after 2 years of the AMLO administration. But we do know that there's a National Guard there. That National Guard, of course, was created to try to respond to public security, but has been used for other issues, in particular controlling migration. So there's this strange relationship between AMLO and the military. He needs them, but we've also seen their budget being increased. And so you can see that there is a very peculiar relationship where there's suspicion, AMLO needs them, and they're beginning to like the fact that they're getting more resources from the AMLO administration.
And what's interesting, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but the military has never been in power in the way that it, at least not directly in power in the way that it has in a lot of South American countries. The relationship that you're describing here is a political one, but it also sounds like AMLO is relying upon them generally for HR, for human resources, right? To execute his projects at a time when the civilian portion of the state, let's say, has limited resources, as is always the case in Mexico, given, you know, how small the state is compared to some of the South American countries. And also at a time when the private sector also sees him with skepticism and is not willing to help with some of these development projects. Does that sound basically accurate to you?
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, and we didn't even mention the fact that the military will surely be called upon to help with the distribution of a vaccine. And I think we've seen that AMLO wants to work with the military because it has the human resources. He also wants to work with the military because, as some of your listeners may know, it is one of the most trusted institutions in Mexico. And so that adds an air of legitimacy. The danger, of course, with all of this, and particularly in the light of the Cienfuegos arrest and then release, is that the more that the Mexican military takes on, the more it gets involved in not just the war on organized crime, but in infrastructure projects, construction, the more it gets exposed to possible charges of corruption, infiltration, and the trust that is so treasured by Mexican generals begins to erode. And I think that's one of the great risks or threats that we're seeing right now.
You know, we started this year, 2020, with an issue of America's Quarterly that talked about how armed forces across so much of the region were coming back into the spotlight in terms of their participation in politics. But again, I think that that is certainly one of the trends that COVID-19 has accelerated so far this year. So, Duncan, let's move beyond that. What's the Biden-AMLO relationship going to look like in sort of broad strokes? Where do you think that's headed? What do you think the atmospherics around it will be? Do you think that there will be some strain at the beginning because of AMLO having declined, at least so far, to recognize Biden as the victor on November 3rd? And ultimately, what do you think it means for policy?
I see Joe Biden as somebody who has followed institutional approaches his entire professional life. I think he's an institution builder. He believes in using the established channels for communication and diplomacy. And I think that that's what we're going to see. Yes, there will be an initial awkwardness. But let's face it, the Mexico-US relationship is simply too important to both countries for that to come in the way of substantive conversations. We will not see the peculiar relationship that we saw between AMLO and Trump. What we'll see, I think, is a much more, you know, statesman-to-statesman kind of approach. We will see a government-to-government approach. It will not be as volatile. There won't be the open threats of border closures and tariffs. I think we're going to go back to the status quo ex ante, which is that the United States will engage with Mexico on multiple fronts. It will use what diplomatic, economic pressure it has to bear to try to get Mexico to do things that that it wants Mexico to do. It will use, ironically, perhaps the institutional mechanisms established under USMCA. At the same time, there's going to be this recognition that the U.S. government needs Mexico. It needs Mexico's ongoing collaboration on migration. It needs Mexico to do a better job on fighting COVID because, you know, we want the Mexican economy to grow. It needs Mexico to do a better job in terms of getting economic growth going again because, you know, obviously it's an important export destination for the United States, but also because of the integrated production chains of North America, we need Mexico to be firing on all cylinders. And of course, you know, the new administration's agenda, we know, is going to be heavily marked on the foreign policy front by climate change. You know, today, well, as we're recording this, we heard about the pending appointment of John Kerry as special envoy for climate. That's going to be something where I think the United States is going to look south. It's going to say, all right, Mexico, you've traditionally been a leader on climate. How can we bring you back? Because we want you to partner with us on this. So we're going to see a multidimensional, much more nuanced approach, but in many ways, a much more traditional approach.
So, Duncan, you know, I was a reporter for so many years, and old habits die hard, and we always sort of try to poke holes. Let me focus on two just to provoke you a little bit. You're describing, at least the way I hear it, a level of engagement or re-engagement from this López Obrador government that is, let's say, not consistent with the interest that it has shown to date in foreign affairs. Put a different way, this is a government that has a very professional foreign ministry, that has its diplomats, but really does not seem to have made these things a priority. Do you think that'll change with the new U.S. administration? Because, you know, AMLO himself has dedicated very little bandwidth to this.
Yeah, and the reason that he's been able to do that is because of the simplicity and the unidimensional approach, I would say, of the Trump administration, which has been to say, you know, you need to help us on migration. Migration is the issue. And so AMLO, as I said earlier on, AMLO has said, if we keep them happy on migration, then they're going to give us a free pass on other things. That will not be the case with a Biden administration. So there has to be a reevaluation of the Mexican approach right now. And, you know, I sincerely hope that our colleagues down there in Mexico City are thinking about how they're going to approach the relationship with the Biden administration. That will be pressuring them on multiple fronts. You're absolutely right though, Brian. I mean, AMLO is not a man who is interested in having a multidimensional relationship with the United States. And part of that comes down to the fact that, of course, he doesn't want to have U.S. interference in domestic affairs in Mexico. And we're going back to the old style priester approach to foreign relations, which is, you know, you mind your own business and I'll mind mine. And that's what he has said repeatedly. The best foreign policy is a good domestic policy. But I think he's going to meet a horse of a different color with President-elect Biden. He's going to have to deal with not just Biden as president, but I think, you know, with a State Department that wants to re-engage, a Justice Department that wants to re-engage, Homeland Security that wants to re-engage. And that's going to mean a lot of work for his administration.
Migration will no longer be the issue under Biden in the same way that it was under Trump, but it will still be a issue. Here's my question, and it may be very naive or reflect an imperfect understanding of the dynamic today. But my read is that López Obrador responded to the Trump administration's demand for greater policing and greater cooperation on the issue of Central American migration specifically because of this perceived threat. I mean, the calculus from Mexico City basically seemed to be, if we, Mexico, don't play ball on this and try to create the fabled quote-unquote Southern Wall, we could suffer tariffs and other kinds of retaliation. My question is, with that threat gone, with that vindictive approach to bilateral relationship now kind of off the table in favor of this new approach you're describing, do you believe that Mexican enthusiasm for essentially policing Central Americans coming across its southern border will now disappear or at least diminish?
There's an interesting phenomenon, which I'm sure that you picked up on when you were in Mexico, which is that there is an underlying fear in Mexico that, you know, if you don't keep the Leviathan north of the border happy, then things are going to go badly for you. And I think that the logic for AMLO is still there. It's not about specific threats of closing the border. It's not about the threat of tariffs. It's about, I want to keep them out of my business. And so I'll do whatever it takes to make sure that I still have that freedom at home. What I suspect, though, is that the pressure is going to be on many different fronts so that that won't be such an easy goal to achieve for AMLO.
So many people seem to think that there will be a crisis at the southwest border in early 2021 because of these hurricanes and other conditions in Central America, because of economic conditions in Mexico, that by that point, I mean, Mexico might not be number one on the list, but it may end up quite high. Let's talk about the economy. We referenced this during the introduction. Even in the context of Latin America, it is a really tough economy in 2020. Most forecasts point to a GDP contraction of more than 9%. What can you tell me just about the latest news that you've seen there? Do you think that there's any possibility of a firm bounce back? Maybe it's okay to contract by 9 as long as you bounce back 8 the following year. But the private investment sentiment in Mexico, based on what I hear, doesn't really seem to point to that, at least not right now.
I think that's certainly accurate. And the common refrain that you hear in Mexico is thank God for USMCA, because without that, Mexico would be so much worse. Double-digit contraction this year, I don't think there's much doubt about that. But let's not forget that, you know, a double-digit contraction is forecast for Canada as well. The difference is, of course, that Canada has been so much more successful in terms of controlling the pandemic. You know, if you were to have a severe contraction in Mexico, but you were only seeing tens of thousands rather than hundreds of thousands dead, then I think that, you know, there may be more understanding. And the fact is that that's not what we're seeing in Mexico. We're seeing, you know, more than 100,000 officially dead, but double it and maybe 2.5 times that is what the real death toll is from COVID in Mexico. So you've got a pandemic of really disastrous proportions. You've got an economic contraction. You've got a missed opportunity on the economy, I think, as well. You know, I mentioned USMCA as being, in some ways, the savior of Mexico at this point in time. But you cannot forget that this is a time of economic conflict between the United States and China. We should be seeing investment flooding into Mexico as nearshoring, reshoring takes place. But, you know, the AMLO administration, or rather AMLO himself, seems determined to do everything he can to dissuade, to deter investors from coming to Mexico. Yes, he says that he's open to international investors, that he wants more of it. But the fact is, look at what he says and does on a daily basis. Look at what the ruling Morena party does in Congress. Look at what is happening to the regulatory institutions in Mexico. It seems as though everything is designed to deter investors. I just find that perhaps the saddest part of the story about Mexico today, which is that if AMLO would just be a little more flexible, he could be bringing in a lot more investment. He could be creating more jobs. He could be creating more prosperity for Mexicans today and in the future. And the fact is that doesn't fit in with his worldview. It's clear he's interested in Mexico as a simpler, more closed, more nationalistic country. And of course, that's not particularly appealing to investors.
Do you really think he doesn't want Mexico to be more prosperous, or does he just have different ideas on how to get there than most people in the private sector do?
You know, there's one thing that I've noticed about the kind of language that he uses when he talks about corruption, when he talks about neoliberalism, which of course he equates with corruption, when he talks about getting rid of the privileges enjoyed by scientists, academics, doctors, etc. He seems to see money as the root of all evil. Now, he doesn't want an economic meltdown of the country. That's why he was behind USMCA. He knows that that would be disastrous for his administration if there is a financial crisis in the country. It's why he's so interested in maintaining the value of the peso versus the dollar. But he's not interested in giving up control in order to have more money in the country. And that doesn't just mean foreign investors. That means national investors. You know, I always like to say that I think that López Obrador is interested in economics only insofar as it serves political purposes. And so you can lay out the facts and figures, you can lay out statistics, you can lay out debt agency ratings for him, and he doesn't care. Because unless that directly impacts his ability to centralize power, then it's of only secondary concern to him.
Well, and you mentioned the possibility that he might change. But here's the thing, as our kind of final tableau here on this episode today, we have been talking about all these issues with Cienfuegos and the problematic relationship with the military and the rising homicides and the devastating effect of the pandemic and an economy that is bad even by Latin American standards. And recent polls show that his approval rating is as high as 64-65%, which would be its highest in a year. How do you explain that? And do you see any incentive for him and for Mexico to sort of change in the next 12 months?
Quite honestly, I don't see the incentive for him to change. The incentive will have to come from either from pressure from outside of Mexico. That could be a foreign government. It could be the U.S. government. It could be from markets. It could come internally from a meltdown of the economy, but I don't think that's likely for the time being. And the question for me comes down to, well, why is the man so popular? And it's a very simple answer, I think, which is that for years, for decades, Mexicans have been neglected by their governments. And finally, somebody comes along that speaks their language, that shows concern for their welfare, that connects with them on an almost spiritual level. And Mexicans are grateful for that. But most importantly, if you go behind the approval rating, and you look at some of the other questions, Brian, they regularly ask Mexicans, do you think that AMLO has the capacity to solve problems? And a vast majority of Mexicans say, no, he doesn't. But what they're grateful for is the fact that he identifies with them and they identify with him.
They feel seen, to use the modern vernacular, is kind of what I'm hearing.
They do feel seen, but I would even go beyond that. You know, you watch the footage of an AMLO rally, you see the way that people connect with him. And it's not just as some lofty figure up there on the stage, it's that they feel that he's one of them. And that matters. You know, if we are in an era of identity politics, the identity that AMLO puts out there is in tune with the identity of a majority of the Mexican population. Now, you could also go to a more cynical approach, which is that AMLO has boosted, cash transfers for a lot of Mexicans, by some estimates, more than 50 million Mexicans. He has raised the minimum wage twice. Those things matter. These kind of policies really do in essence, they buy support because, you know, even in the middle of a recession, a lot of Mexicans have more money in their pocket now than they did before he came into power. So there's a sort of a spiritual identity-based explanation, and there's a much more realpolitik, practical or pragmatic explanation that we can call on there based on money.
Duncan, as we said at the beginning of the podcast, it's a lot. But we went through a lot of it today. It's much clearer to me now, and it's such a great country in so many respects. I know we wish it both the best, and thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you for listening to the America's Quarterly podcast. You can read more at americasquarterly.org. Finally, if you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a review, give us a rating, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The America's Quarterly podcast is produced by Brendan O'Boyle and Leonie Rawls. America's Quarterly is an independent, not-for-profit publication of America's Society and the Council of the Americas.